This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it's a mixed bag for the Democratic Party after results are in from the Massachusetts primary elections. Only half of the candidates that the party endorsed were chosen by the voters. Lots to unpack as we now look to a general election. It's just weeks away. Here to help us make sense of it all, WBUR reporter Walter Wuthman, who joins us on the line from the Elks Lodge in West Roxbury, where Republican candidate for governor Jeff Diehl just held his first press conference of the general election campaign. Walt, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
And here in the studio, Sharman Sacchetti, political reporter for WCVB and my seatmate for a number of the debates this summer. Sharman, welcome to the studio.
Thanks for having me.
So there is a lot to break down, Walt and Sharman. I think we should start with the governor's race. Sharman, I'm going to turn to you first. No surprise on Maura Healey. Sonia Chang-Diaz pulled out of active campaigning back in July. She goes on now to face Republican Jeff Diehl in the general. Do you think the lack of a primary challenge helps her or hurts her now?
I always think, I come from the school of thought that a primary challenge can really help a candidate, can sharpen their message, can sharpen their focus. But, you know, it really did, in the grand scheme of things, sort of help her take this more moderate tact, which is what we heard from her last night. She, during her speech, she came out early. She declared victory early. She dropped Charlie Baker's name a few times and said, you know, she would sort of govern in the way of she said she was proud of the way he governed, with sort of a nod to the bipartisanship that he likes to talk about. And she characterized her opponents. At that time, we didn't know it was Jeff Diehl, as you know, Trumpism, wanting to bring Trumpism to Massachusetts. So I think everything last night broke the way Maura Healey wanted it to. I think she wanted to run against Jeff Diehl. She can cast him now as a, quote, you know, as a Trumpist. And really draw a contrast.
So let's turn to you now, Walt Wuthman. You're there where Jeff Diehl held his first general election event this morning. There'd been some chatter, including from former Boston Globe Statehouse Bureau Chief Frank Phillips, that Chris Doty, who was the other Republican in the primary race, was really picking up some steam headed into the finish line. But Diehl did win by about 25,000 votes. Is there a sense that he took it and there was no risk there today, Walt, or is there a sense of, woof, thank goodness?
He seemed pretty relaxed, and I would say his acceptance speech last night was pretty relaxed, too. A question I had going into this press conference today was, okay, he's in the general election now. He's going against Maura Healey. Is he going to moderate his tone a little bit? And I think that at least the early answer is no. He brought up, you know, still being upset about vaccine mandates, about wanting to rehire any state workers that were fired because of vaccine mandates. He brought up school choice and wanting to divert public funding to homeschool and private school options. Jim Lyons, the chair of the state Republican Party, was railing against drag queen story hours at public libraries. It did not sound like someone trying to follow in the footsteps of Charlie Baker.
So let me stay with you on that for a minute longer, Walt. Last night, when he turned to the general election, he painted Healey, quote, as the people's worst nightmare. That was in his victory speech. She seems so far to be taking a more bipartisan approach, like Sharman was just telling us. Are they going to stay in those lanes? How ugly are you expecting this to get, Walt?
I think it will get ugly. I think politics in Massachusetts always does. But I really agree with Sharman's point that I think Maura Healey was helped by not really having a strong primary opponent, because she can appear bipartisan and she can go after those Democrats who vote for Baker. I spoke to quite a few of them at the polls yesterday, Democrats and independents who say, you know, I really wish I could have voted for Baker for a third term, but I like Maura Healey just fine, and so I feel comfortable voting for her. I think Maura Healey's really going to try to get as many of those types of people to vote for her as possible.
So, Sharman, I'll turn back to you. We have Sharman Sacchetti from WCVB here in the studio on Radio Boston as we talk about yesterday's primary results. One of the things that struck me, WBUR's Anthony Brooks talked yesterday to a voter who said that her big issue was illegal immigration. Walt just listed the list that Jeff Diehl, the Republican candidate for governor now, went through this morning. It made us think of a conversation. Bear with me. We had a conversation with former Newton Mayor Seti Warren back in March. We were launching a series on stepping up on tough leadership and leadership in the times of challenge. And he observed that as he finished his mayoralty, he felt like the pushback that he was starting to get was based on national issues, national talking points. Here he is, Sharman.
People are getting their news from not local newspapers, but they're getting their news from platforms now, and they're getting the news from television, which has nationalized in some ways our local conversation.
So Deal is a Trump guy. Trump held a tele-rally for him on Monday night. Charlie Baker is widely popular in the state, but not nationally. Are we seeing the nationalization of politics in our statewide races?
Well, I think it's a matter of what the candidates choose to focus on. And in Jeff Deal's case, yes, we are. He's talking about national issues. And that was one thing that his primary opponent, Chris Doty, kept on sort of harping on during the primary, where he was saying, you know, the national focus is not really what I want to do as governor. That doesn't really have an impact. That was something he said as early as yesterday before the polls closed. So I think that there certainly is in both camps sort of a focus on national issues. Abortion is a major issue here in Massachusetts, certainly for the left and also for the right. And so people do tend to include that in who they vote for.
Walter Withman, I'll turn back to you. I remember sitting here in Studio 2 during the debate for Secretary of the Commonwealth, and challenger Bill Galvin, the secretary, won last night. He was challenged by Tanisha Sullivan, who's the head of the local NAACP, and she very squarely put abortion and what had happened with the U.S. Supreme Court on the table for the Secretary of the Commonwealth race. Did you observe a lot of nationalizing of issues on the Democratic side during these statewide races?
I would say more on the Republican side, but I do think that abortion is a major issue for Democrats nationally, and I think it is going to be one they continue to lean on locally here in Massachusetts. You had the state legislature shore up abortion rights even more after the Supreme Court's decision. You have the new climate legislation in Washington. I think you're going to see probably more action on Beacon Hill around climate. It's ways to localize national issues, but I agree with Sharman's point that I think Jeff Deal is really, really trying to nationalize this race, highlighting his support from Trump, talking about driver's licenses for undocumented immigrants, and you know what he says is a flood of illegal immigration, things you don't really think about on a day-to-day kind of Massachusetts potholes, roads, taxes issues. He's bringing these big cultural issues to the front.
Although I will flag, and I loud and clear, Walt, but I will flag just for listeners that later when we take up ballot issues, this question of driver's licenses is a ballot
question. Local issue.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it's become local. Based on a law that Governor Baker signed earlier this year. All right, I'm going to move us on to the Attorney General's race. I mean, we could talk all of these races all day. I've got Sharman Sacchetti from WCVB here in the studio and WBUR's Walter Withman on the line from a Jeff Deal campaign event this morning. Andrea Campbell was victorious on the Democrat side against Shannon Liss Reardon. Quentin Palfrey had also been running. He withdrew, about a week and a half ago. He stepped back and endorsed Campbell. We'll get to that in a minute. Both of you, Sharman, both you and Walt, have covered these races. When people talk about those candidates, what did they say? We know what the candidates said the issues were. What did people say the issues were?
To be fair, I talk to the candidates more than these days. But I will say that we've seen before, we've seen this play out before where one candidate is self-funded and pours a lot of money in and they don't win in the end.
Shannon Liss Reardon, in this case, who used about $9 million of her own
money. More than
money.
$9 million. It was a lot of money. And in the end, it may end up being a little bit more than that. But that said, she managed to double her name recognition inside of a span of like 2 months. So by getting up on TV the way she did. So And then she secured some pretty powerful endorsements with Senator Warren and Mayor Michelle Wu. But it wasn't enough. And Andrea Campbell, it sort of got testy sort of in the end there, where Andrea Campbell was accusing Shannon Liz Reardon of trying to buy the race. And Liz Reardon was saying, look, I don't have a list of donors right now, so this is my best way to get my message out.
So, Walt, you were out at the polls yesterday. We talked to you for a couple of minutes, and I wonder, at the various polling places, was there anyone who was saying, it is the AG's race, that's the reason I'm here, this is the thing I'm charged up about? Because it was a very contentious race. But was that just inside sort of hashtag Massachusetts politics, or more broadly?
I did speak to a couple people who said actually that they came out for the AG's race. Both were Andrea Campbell supporters, and they both really resonated with her personal story and her message. But I didn't detect any strong, you know, dislike of Shannon Liz Reardon or Quentin Palfrey, who dropped out. I think people seemed to be generally okay with all of the options. I will say I interviewed Quentin Palfrey after he dropped out, and he endorsed Andrea Campbell, which may have helped her right at the end there, because the polls had shown the race tightening. And that did cause a little bit of heat. Shannon Liz Reardon accused him of trying to curry political favor with the front runner. He told me he was disappointed to hear that, but he just really liked Andrea Campbell personally, that she has heart, that she has a really strong story, and he had really bonded with her on the campaign trail and wanted to support her. Maybe his endorsement helped get her over the edge, but it was a pretty commanding victory for Andrea Campbell in the end last night.
And Sharman, it was also interesting to watch powerful women in Democratic politics square off on this one. So Elizabeth Warren backs Shannon Liz Reardon. So does, for example, Boston Mayor Michelle Wu, former Boston mayoral candidate and interim Boston Mayor Kim Janey. On the other side, you have Maura Healey herself, who polls would suggest will be the next governor of Massachusetts, squaring off for Andrea Campbell. Are we seeing shades of struggle for who's in charge of the party in the state here?
Well, it certainly seems that way. It certainly seems that the sort of the real progressive end of things didn't have a great night last night. And Maura Healey spent more time on the campaign trail campaigning for Andrea Campbell than really herself. I mean, she's out there for herself as well, but we all knew that she had basically cleared the field. So I think this couldn't have gone, this night couldn't have gone any better for Healey. And for women, generally speaking, given that now on the Democratic side, we're going to have two women at the top of the ticket for governor and lieutenant governor. I mean, statewide offices, there are a lot more women, which is saying something for Massachusetts, because Massachusetts, while we've had female governors, we've never elected a female governor. So that's saying something.
Yeah. My colleague Chris Sidorek pointed out that the only Democratic statewide primary race not won by a woman was Secretary of State, where Bill Galvin, you know, won access potentially, if he wins in the general against Rayla Campbell, he won access to an eighth term. So, Walt, I want to pick up on a theme that Sharman Sacchetti just brought up, which is, and I noticed that I want to give credit to Lisa Kaczynski of Politico, who I read talking about this morning, and it stirred some thinking for me. Every candidate endorsed by progressive Massachusetts on the Democratic side, Walter Wuthman, lost. And the Democratic Party itself technically picked more losers than winners. It was a 50-50 split between who they picked and who actually won, but one of their picks was running unopposed and so was going to win. Is that surprising, Walt?
I think it is surprising, and I think if you work for the organization, you probably don't feel great this morning. But I don't know if there is like a real lesson to be learned yet. I mean, this was a really low turnout primary election. A lot of these candidates do not have a lot of name recognition. So I would be interested in when we have more data, kind of looking at, okay, who actually voted? What are the demographics? Is this really a huge drubbing for progressives, or is it going to look better for them in a general election, or is it going to look better for them, you know, when there's a presidential election at the top of the ticket, when you actually have a lot more people voting?
So, Sharman, I'll turn to you first on this next one. We do want to leave time for the Suffolk County DA's race, which we've covered extensively here on Radio Boston. And so I'm not going to give us the whole rundown because I've been trying to practice and I can't get it under about 4 minutes, the whole rundown of the story. But you covered it heavily. And Ricardo Arroyo, Boston City Councilor, just conceded this morning after both he and DA Kevin Hayden had scandals basically break through the Boston Globe. You've covered this heavily. Are you surprised this morning, and what were you expecting?
I was not surprised by this. It was a bruising primary, and it was especially bruising in the final weeks. So no, I was not surprised by this. I've read a lot about this. I've covered it, extensively. We covered the court case. Ricardo Arroyo going to court to try to release those documents.
Two accusations that he was investigated for sexual assault in his teenage years in 2005 and 2007.
And so it was, I think, a lot to overcome. I will say that. It was a lot.
So, Walt Withman, you caught up with Ricardo Arroyo over the weekend while he was campaigning, correct?
Yes. Yeah, I did, in Dorchester.
And tell us about that a little bit.
Yeah, it did strike me because it was the final week in the campaigning. You know, I think he thought he was going to, you know, have a crowd of people like Boston Mayor Michelle Wu and Ayanna Pressley and Senator Warren behind him and as surrogates kind of going all across the district, you know, raising his name and his message up. And he was totally alone. It was just him and his aide. And then I caught up with them right outside this park on the street. And you could tell that he was exhausted. He seemed kind of sad. I walked away from the interview kind of thinking, I wonder if he thinks it's over. I mean, clearly he fought till the very end. He didn't concede last night. But it was kind of a striking image for someone in their final weekend of campaigning.
And I should note that the people that you just listed withdrew endorsements as the scandal unfolded.
Yeah.
Sharman, I'll turn.
All had endorsed. Yeah, yeah.
No,
they'd all endorsed him, and they had all withdrawn them after the second Globe story.
But yeah, but not immediately. Ed Flynn and Joe Kennedy withdrew immediately. But Senator Warren, you had Michelle Wu, many people hung on there for a bit, Ayanna Pressley. But they didn't endorse Hayden, worth mentioning. They just said, we can't endorse in this race. And so all of that happened just days before the actual primary took place.
So, Sharman, one last question to you. We talked to Democratic strategist Susan Tracy about the race last Friday before we knew how things were going to turn out. But as this was just a couple of days after all the endorsements had gone away, and what she really wanted to focus on was how we move forward after a winner was declared, which, of course, last night, the declaration, this morning, Arroyo concedes. Here's Susan Tracy.
How, as a city, we respond after this election, no matter which one of them gets elected, is going to be really important. Because if the anger that we are seeing in the city council and the anger that we are seeing on the streets in these campaigns continues post-Tuesday, that's a very bad thing for our city.
So what do we do now, Sharman?
Well, that's a good question. I was inside city council chambers when all of that chaos broke out.
Last Wednesday,
while they were talking about stripping Councilor Arroyo of his chairmanships. And that was, I have covered many Boston City Council hearings. I have never covered one like that. So I'm not sure. But I think she makes a really great point.
Yes, she's most strikingly to me compared what she saw that day to the era of busing in the early 1970s, and that was quite striking. So last question to you, Walt Withman. What's the biggest question looming for you now as a reporter as we go into this general election?
I think one of the ones I had this morning was, now does Jeff Deal take a different tack, and does he look a little more moderate going into a general election? I think the answer is no. And then to your question about how the city moves on with this DA's race, I mean, it looks like Kevin Hayden is going to be the DA. I think there are still very fair questions raised by the Globe reporting about his handling of this case with the MBTA transit officer. And I think that if the city's going to move forward, there's a lot of there are answers he needs to provide about that and show leadership on to gain the trust of people who did not vote for him.
All right. Walter Wuthman is a reporter here at WBUR. Sharman Sacchetti is political reporter for WCVB. Thanks to both of you. Back to school season is stressful. New classrooms, new routines, new peers. All that uncertainty can be especially overwhelming for kids with food allergies, as well as for their parents. A few weeks ago here on the show, we talked with Marta Bosmer. She's a nurse at Boston Green Academy, which serves kids grades 6 through 12. And she told us this year she expects allergies to be a bigger challenge than ever.
I think I had like 65 EpiPens last year. Yeah, wow. That's a lot of EpiPens to take care of. So just renewing all that medicine, you got to renew the orders from the doctors. You got to get the new EpiPens in the build. I mean, the work is incredible.
So that got us thinking, and we invited Marta back here to the studio today to help us pick up on this thread of food allergies in school for our latest edition of Be Well, where we explore your health and ours. Marta, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you.
And we asked another previous guest on the show, Dr. Dan Rauch, who's chief of pediatric hospital medicine at Tufts School of Medicine, to join us as well. Dr. Rauch, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
It's good to have both of you. So, Marta, 65 EpiPens last year. I know you told us you inventory at the beginning of the year. What's that number looking like now?
Yeah, you know, I think with COVID having it's not in the rearview mirror, but, you know, it just had happened. And I think a lot of changes have happened in schools. So I know that I have a ton of new freshmen. I have a ton of new ninth graders. So that's new EpiPens coming in for sure. It's just over the years, they've ticked up. Every year, I feel like I have more and more. Every class, it's like my ninth grade will have 20, my eighth grade will have 10, my seventh, and then it's always more the next year. So I see that happening right now and just trying to keep track of what I already have and what I need to get. It's a lot of work.
So I can imagine parents listening to this and saying, okay, well, as a school nurse, I sent in my kid's EpiPen. How are you keeping track? So Marta, how do you keep track of all of that, and are you in touch with families?
Yeah, it's incredible. So I kind of have a setup where it's funny. I had this friend of mine came in and worked for me one day, this nurse, when I was out. And I came back in, and she had put all these, like, shoe hangers up on the wall with every kid's name in it and their EpiPen inside of it, because I had a different system on the back of my door, you know. So every nurse, I think, in every office has a different system of the way they keep track of them. But I want to have, like, the kid's name. I want to have their picture, if I can have their picture. And I want to make sure that I'm keeping track of, like, what teacher knows what. So I kind of go grade level by grade level. I pick up my sixth grade. I run, like, it's called a condition and alerts, like, tab I can take on the computer. And every kid with a food allergy, boom, list. I take that list. I go to all the teachers. I make a phone call to all the families. I make sure I get in all the pens. I kind of just keep a list of who gave me what and when and what I need.
Yeah. We're talking food allergies at the beginning of the school year with school nurse Marta Bosmer and pediatrician Dr. Dan Rauch. Dr. Rauch, I guess I'm assuming that you would not be surprised by the number of EpiPens Marta is talking about. But am I wrong? Is that kind of volume surprising?
No, the volume isn't surprising, and we've seen over the last couple decades that there's been a tremendous rise in food allergies, and there's a bunch of theories why that is, but nobody really knows for sure. I would add that I'm tremendously impressed with the effort that Marta's putting into this. On the one hand, though, what's most important is that there are EpiPens available. It doesn't really matter who they are assigned to, and there are some school districts which actually will say, even if a child hasn't brought one in or for whatever reason it's not available, they'll just grab the closest one. They're dosed the same. The most important thing is that people use the EpiPens. So having them in the building isn't quite as important as knowing how to use them and when to use them.
And is it difficult to do that, Dr. Rauch? Do you teach people how to use EpiPens? For example, I imagine families, when you start talking with them about their kids who have food allergies, do they take to it easily?
So it's literally stabbing your kid in the leg with a needle. It's a fairly simple thing to do if you can get over the actual act of it. There are practice setups that hopefully whoever's prescribing this to you has gone over that with you in the office. Pharmacies can do this as well. You can get these at home to practice. All of that's easier said than done when actually you need it. So you have to get over the fear in the situation, which is why it's so important to have school nurses in schools, not just visiting, you know, rotating through for a couple hours every day, but actually stationed in the school because they're professionals who are used to doing this.
Forgive my ignorance on this. I had food allergies as a child, but EpiPens weren't really a thing there then. Yeah. Is that a prescription or can you buy EpiPens over the counter?
No, it is a prescription, and unfortunately, it's it can be quite expensive. So there is an issue of access, and then in the not-too-distant past, there was an issue of just getting it. There was a shortage of epinephrine, at least in the pens. The other thing is, not infrequently, you need a second dose, so they should be prescribed in pairs, and some people are, if they've had them for a long time, are used to only having one, and they also should be renewed on a yearly basis. And you should have them wherever the kid's going to be regularly. So, yes, it should be in school. It should be at home. But if they have an after-school activity, which is at neither one of those places, there should be EpiPens available there as well.
So, Marta Bosmer, you're at Boston Green Academy. Two things running through my head as I listen to Dr. Rauch. The first, this sounds a lot like inhalers, right? You have to have lots of them. You have to have them a lot of different places. They can be expensive. You need a prescription. And two, he raised this point, well, what if you don't have a prescription? What if your family can't get an EpiPen? I mean, these are not optional treatment when the moment comes. How do you deal with and think about that?
Yeah, for sure. So I have an emergency EpiPen that I tell a family, if they can't bring one in or send one in, I have one. I got you. The other thing, asthma inhalers, oh my God, they go hand in hand with EpiPen. I feel like every time I need an inhaler, I need an EpiPen, maybe for the same kid. But the list kind of looks similar. I'd say the numbers are pretty even with asthma inhalers and EpiPens in my school right now. I will say this about, you know, having the EpiPen wherever the kid is. So I have a school that we do this, we do a project week yearly where all the kids go to all these different places in the city with different staff throughout the week. And for me, I'm kind of building up my EpiPen stock for that week so that each kid can go where they want to go. So I'm not holding anybody back. I want, you know, I want them to have the same treatment every other kid gets that doesn't have a food allergy. I'm training all my staff. I do that twice a year. I have the staff, I kind of show them a demonstration, and then I have them demonstrate back to me. I have a little checklist I go off. Boston does that for each school. So each nurse is in charge of doing that with their staff so that if I'm not there or if they're on a field trip, I make sure that staff member has that and that they know how to do that and that they're trained. It's a lot of work, but it's worth it. It is a lot, though. It can become overwhelming pretty quickly. I think my list of EpiPens and who I need and what I have already are like gold to me,
yeah.
Making sure I don't lose those.
Yeah. So we are talking about food allergies and back to school food allergy treatment, et cetera. You just heard from Marta Bosmer, who's a school nurse at the Boston Green Academy. We also have Dr. Dan Rauch, who's chief of pediatric hospital medicine at Tufts School of Medicine. I'm going to play a little sound for you, Dr. Rauch. This is Dr. Chen Rosenberg, an allergist and immunologist at Mass General Hospital, about the kind of the prevalence of allergy diagnosis for kids and that increase.
So about 1 in 13 will have a food allergy, which is about 2 kids per classroom. Over the past several decades, that number has risen from, I would say, like 2 to 3 to 4 to 5, now up to 6 to 8%.
So I can imagine a parent hearing that and saying, well, if I don't know that my child has food allergies, how can I tell? How do we know that a kid had a food allergy, Dr. Rauch?
So there's a breakdown of the type of allergy. There's the allergy that we're concerned about for the EpiPens, which is an anaphylactic allergy. And that's the worst case scenario, and that is your airway swells up and you can't breathe and you die. Then there's allergies where you just have some GI upset or you have some diarrhea. Those can overlap, so you want to be take those symptoms very seriously. Fortunately, most kids with food allergies don't have the anaphylaxis. So if your child has been eating something that and they had a reaction, you're not sure if it's something that they ate, you can discuss it with your primary care provider and get a referral to an allergist and they can do testing.
We have a question from one of our listeners. We reached out to our texting group and gave them an opportunity to ask questions. And Edward from Saugus, Dr. Rauch, wants to know, should parents with children allergic to, for example, peanuts, be encouraged to desensitize their kids?
So where you have the availability to do that, and peanuts is one of the big breakthroughs in peanut allergy management, is the desensitization plans. And absolutely, because any allergy that you have anaphylaxis to could kill you, and that would be a bad outcome. So if we could do something to prevent that outcome from happening, the EpiPens are one way to do that. Desensitization is another way to do that. By all means, you should pursue that.
And if you listeners would like to join our texting group, you can do that by texting the word Boston to 617-766-0382. That's Boston to 617-766-0382 to get started. I'd really love to hear from you. Turning back to you now, Marta, now I'm imagining we're in school. You've got kids of lots of different ages. You've got people eating lunch. You've got snacks and backpacks. You've got the chaos that is simply a school day. How does one manage in a school environment to keep help kids keep from coming in contact with food allergens?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. You know, I think a lot of it is talking about it a lot. I think it's a subject I find myself talking about more than I ever thought that I would, I guess. When I'm in school, you're in nursing school and you kind of hear about things, but when you're living it, it's something that's like right at the forefront for me. I'm thinking about it on a field trip. I'm thinking about it. When I know I have a kid with a food allergy, I do have like a check. So I have a check-in with like each kid. Like I'll kind of go find them at the beginning of the year and just say, you know, you're allergic. You know, you got the high school kids, they get it. The younger kids, I might want to like have more of a conversation with them, but I'm just kind of reminding everybody. I'm reminding my staff about snacks. See, food allergies is one of those things where you don't come, you don't have a crisis every day. You got, I was thinking, I think I've given 6 or 7 in 15 years, EpiPens. That's not a lot, so you don't get a ton of practice with it. But it's like second nature when it happens, for sure. I mean, I am like, on the inside, I'm totally freaking out. On the outside, I'm as calm as can be
getting
to that
done.
Kid. I got you. Yep. I remember the first time I ever gave when the kid said, I'm scared. And I was like, you know what? I am too, but I got you. You know, we got this. You're going to be okay. But I remember that moment of like, wow, it is kind of scary. And I always say to my staff, like, you want me to be the one giving it. I know you do. So if you, you know, if you bring in stuff like that, the higher the risk that somebody comes in contact with something. So let's like try to think about the snacks we're bringing in so that we don't have that issue. And if it happens, we do take care of it. Definitely. You know.
And Dr. Rauch, what is the most important piece of advice that you give to parents when they discover that their child has a food allergy?
So the most important piece of advice is use the EpiPen. If you have any question, if your kid's having an allergic reaction, that has been shown to save lives. Give the EpiPen. If your kid didn't need it, if it was something else, they'll get a little jumpy. They won't feel great about it. But if they're having an anaphylaxis reaction, early Epi saves lives. So when in doubt, give the medicine to the child. And that's the most important thing. Secondly, not everybody has Marta in their school, so you want to develop a plan. All the planning that she discussed that she does with her staff doesn't happen at every school. So sometimes the parents have to take the bull by the horns and go to the school and make sure that there's EpiPens traveling with their kid, that someone knows how to deliver the EpiPen so that medicine can get in the kid who needs it.
All right. Super helpful from both of you. Dr. Dan Rauch is chief of pediatric hospital medicine at Tufts School of Medicine, and Marta Bosmer is a nurse at Boston Greed Academy. Thanks so much to both of you. Really appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a question for you. Are you a comic book fan, or maybe you like graphic novels? Millions of people are, and according to industry analysts, Comicron and ICV2, they were a $2 billion industry in the U.S. and in Canada last year. And they're also a powerful, flexible form of art, which let artists and the readers tackle hard issues with, pun kind of intended, a lot of punch sometimes. Joel Christian Gill is a cartoonist and the author of the graphic novel-style memoir Fights, One Boy's Triumph Over Violence, which we talked about with Joel here on Radio Boston in 2020. He's also the inaugural chair of Boston University's new MFA program in visual narrative. And we are starting a regular segment with him today on the world of comics and graphic art storytelling. Joel, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you. So what is it about comics?
Comics are a sneaky way to teach people things, and because of cartooning, and specifically the empathy and the expressive drawing in cartooning, we pour ourselves into it, right? This is why Charles Schulz is a beloved cartoonist, because those little simple cartoons, like, we all relate to that. And I think that when people see those things, they don't just see, like, Charlie Brown, they see themselves. And I think that's why cartoons and comics sort of resonate to so many people.
And for the less initiated like me, the difference between a comic book and a graphic novel, how would you, as an artist, distinguish?
There's no such thing.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. People, like, I think graphic novel is just the fancy way of saying comics, because it's all the same things. It would be like saying the difference between a painting on acrylic versus a painting on a canvas versus a painting on paper, right? They're not different, right? They're just like different. They're different formats, or sort of like the way you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think a lot of people, and sometimes people don't like to even say, you know, Joel, you're a comic book artist or a cartoonist. That sounds like, doesn't sound as special for what you do. But in reality, comics are comics, right? Whether they're short or long, they're comics, right? And so there's no difference between comics and a graphic novel. And I think that most people just apply that language, like graphic novels are more serious. But I've seen some really silly graphic novels as well. So,
so it's interesting. When I went to read Fights to prepare for talking with you back in 2020, I had read a couple of graphic novels, not many.
Yep.
And I approached it with a little trepidation, like, I know how a book is going to speak to me.
Yep.
I don't know how this is going to speak to me. And what was really interesting about it was the extent to which those pictures made me connect with you as a boy in a way. And I feel like I'm betraying people who write just books because I love literature, right? But there was an ability to connect with the story you were telling that I felt in my stomach,
yeah,
with every page.
And I think, yeah, and I think that's because of the expressive quality of cartooning in general, right? Like, you're drawing these simple pictures and you're drawing them not very specifically. And so because you're not drawing them specifically, because I'm not drawing an actual portrait of me, I am drawing a simplified version of me. And so that makes it a much more every person, right? You can actually pour yourself into that. And I think—
You meaning the reader.
Yeah, you the reader, right? So when you look at, it's almost like, you know, in Scott McCloud's Understanding Comics, he talks about this idea that a smiley face is universal, right? When we look at that picture of a smiley face, we don't see the picture of another. We see ourselves in that, right? It's the same reason why we look at light switches or plugs or car grills. When I was a kid, I used to look at car grills and I could always see faces in car grills. And so, like, that's because we are always looking for that, that we're looking for ourselves in something. And so when you draw a caricature or a cartoony character, expressive drawing of a person, which is what cartooning is, right? People always say cartooning is really easy, right? That's a simple little thing you do. In reality, it's not that simple. Like, sit down and try it, right? Try to make something that looks like—
Oh, I have. It's not. It's it, no.
I could teach you. Give me a few weeks and I can, I got you. I'll work it out for you.
All right. So we are talking with Joel Christian Gill, who's just joined the faculty of Boston University, in a beginning of a series to talk about cartooning, comic books, graphic novels, and this graphic art of storytelling. We'll get into your course, actually, which I do want to at Boston University in a minute. But I want to ask you a couple of other questions. First, as we set up this genre, your love for it, what people can come to fall in love with about it. And I think the first thing I'd ask you is, what are the one or two comic books that have been most influential? And I don't even know. Do I ask comic books? Do I ask comic book lines? Like, is it one issue?
I would say comics. Okay. I would just say comics. Yeah. You know, I think I love everything, right? There's a lot of different stories. I love superhero stories. I love sad stories. I love science fiction. I love manga. You know, I love a lot of different things. But recently, I was a judge for the LA Times Review of Books for graphic novels for the last couple years. And two books that really stuck with me was one book called Shadow Life and one that was called One Story by Jippy. Shadow Life is just this amazing little story about this little old lady who just runs away from home. And it's absolutely hilarious. Huh. But halfway through it, she has a fight with death. And she traps death in a vacuum cleaner. So death comes for her and traps her in. And it's just this amazing story. There's this one line in the book where she says her daughters are texting her and they're all caps. And she's like, why are you yelling at me, grumpy pants, right? And I think that's just amazing, right? To like, and it's like, you know, I think that there's this idea that Willem Warringer talks about in his essay, Abstracting and Empathy, and about how, like, sometimes, this is what I got out of it, it's probably broader than this, but he talks about how, like, in order for something to be, for us to all feel ourselves into it, we have to have empathy, right? Like cartooning, right? And some stories are not written for me, right? They're just like this, some stories are written for an old lady, right? But some stories are written for everybody. And even though the protagonist in this book is like an elderly Asian woman, I felt myself in her. And I think that that's what makes me love this book, Shadow Life. And the other book is a book called One Story, which is about generational trauma. And if you read my book, then you know that that's something that's close to me. Like, listening to Kendrick Lamar's, like, Mother, I Sober, you know, didn't make me cry on the bus on the way down here, right? Like, that didn't happen. But In Jippy's book, One Story, it's about generational trauma, but it's kind of like if Kathy Kollwitz, the painter, and J.M.W. Turner, the painter, had a baby that loved Charles Schulz and made comics, it would be Jippy.
Oh, my God.
Right? It's just this amazing comic where he uses, like, the formal elements of art to sort of tell you this story. So when you see line, it's like he's, when it's just black and white line, he's talking to a therapist. When you see this, like, monochromatic green color, it's war. When you see this full color, it's like this magical realism thing. And I think that both of those books are, you know, expressing like really different things, and it shows the depth and breadth of the medium.
So for listeners who are saying, wait, I didn't write those down, we will put his two recommendations on our website at radioboston.org. They will be there for you. Oh my God, there are 800 places. I'm so glad this is not our only segment on this, because there are 800 places we could go. I'm going to pick up this thread because I'm going to start to bring it to comic book culture in here in Boston.
Okay.
So I'm going to play you a little bit of a sound from a show, a play. We covered the play in May. We were talking to Monica White Ndunu, who is a play that she was directing a play called Black Superhero Magic Mama,
okay,
which was performed here in the spring and early summer. It's a story about a mother whose son is shot and killed by the police. And she escapes into, to deal with her grief, into the superhero that he and his teenage friend were designing in a comic book.
Oh, wow.
That they were developing together. So right, the little bit of anima play here, it's Tremarian, played by Joshua Robinson. He's one of the teenagers, and his friend Flat Joe, played by Anderson Stinson III, debating how we should think about superheroes who do and don't have magical powers in comic books.
If you're that powerful and you choose to help people instead of run away, that's admirable. You don't abandon people. You don't leave. You use your powers to help all of
the stupid people.
I was going to say people. Man, I don't even know what I'm talking about no more. Finish your list.
So again, that was Anderson Stinson III as Flat Joe. Joshua Robinson is Tremarian, who is the boy who is killed. And it was as a mother of a teenage son, to see her escape into a comic book world, once again, I thought would feel foreign, and it didn't. For her to escape into this character her son was creating to talk about himself. And she is then a warrior sort of seeking justice through the rest of the play, made me understand the power of this art in a different way. And I just want to get your reflection on that.
We've been doing this for all of human history. We've been escaping into stories, right? This is, you know, Joseph Campbell made an entire career about this, right? When you look at religion, myth, any of these things, we've always been escaping into stories. And I think I read somewhere once where it's like myth, religion is man's way of explaining mysterious things. And I think when you move into that space where you're looking at comics and you get to imagine yourself in a better place. And I think that that's what people do when we tell stories, when we need to escape, right? Like when it was one of those things, my son likes to play Call of Duty, right? I don't like to play Call of Duty because when I want to play a video game, I don't want real life, right? I want to fight monsters. I don't want like war, which is real. And so I think that when that's what people do, like to like leave yourself and to be in this place, this idealistic world where you actually have the power to do something, right? Everybody wants to be Superman. I have problems with Batman, but that's a different segment altogether.
And we can do that one.
Yeah. But super, like everybody wants to do that, right? Because you actually have the power to do some good, right? It's like buying a lottery ticket, right? People buy the lottery ticket not because they're like, oh, I'm going to buy a big house. It's like, I think most people think I'm going to do all these good things, right?
For my family, for the people I love,
right? And superheroes are like, reading a comic book is like buying a lottery ticket and living in that moment for a while, right? Mm-hmm. Until you get to the end, right? Whether it's a graphic novel where there's 250 pages or a floppy or a monthly comic that's 24 pages. You get to live in a different world where there are good and bad, and evil does get conquered, right? And I think that that's what people want. And so to see a mother have something like that happen, and I've had similar things happen in my life, and to be able to live in a place where you could have stopped it or you could have changed it, that's absolutely human. That's human. That's what we do.
So that play was performed here in Boston. It had support by communities of color who are both working on comic books and into comic books. I know we've got some comic book events coming up here in the city. Massachusetts Independent Comics Expo is coming up in October. Boston Comics and Color Festival is next April.
Yep.
Do we have a really strong comic book culture here in Boston?
Oh, yeah. If you go into a coffee shop, you'll find a cartoonist. Just turn over, like just go into a coffee shop and say, who likes comics? And somebody's going to be sitting in the corner drawing something. It's always going to be a thing, right? Like it's like you can't get rid of us, right? We're, you know, like storytelling is human. And it's like, it's, in my opinion, it's what makes us ultimately human. And so connecting that to sharing those stories is just what we do as humans. It's what makes our humanity.
Anything particular about the Boston scene, whether it's our art community or our schools, that makes us particularly supportive or not?
It's probably the schools. I mean, Boston has a lot of thinkers, you know, like the same thing if you were scratches, you go into a coffee shop and ask somebody if they're working on a dissertation, you probably have the same thing happen.
You probably
right?
get two hands raised on that one.
So, I mean, you've got a lot of people who are thinking, I think people who are, I don't want to say free thinkers, but people who are open to the possibility of a lot of things are more open to those things, right? We're more open to ideas about comics and comics being something other than just superheroes. And I think that's what we have here in Boston is that, you know, whether it's the Boston Comics Roundtable, Boston Comic Arts Foundation, Massachusetts Independent Comics Expo, my program in visual narrative, like you've got people who are open to ideas and telling stories. And those stories are broad from, you know, a magic girl who gets on a spaceship and goes to generational trauma.
So let's use our last little bit of time to talk about this new program. You're at BU now, and I'll note BU holds the license for WBUR, and it is on visual narrative.
Right.
What kind of student is coming for that MFA?
People who want to draw comics, people who want to tell stories, people who are super excited about telling stories, whether they be the girl in the spaceship or be generational trauma. Those are the people who I hope to inspire to tell stories. We're going to spend most of the first year doing nonfiction stories and collaborations with people here inside of BU and outside if we can. And then the second year, my students will be working on graphic novels and we'll be just showing those works.
So what are you most excited to teach them? I mean, obviously you'll teach them many, many, many things, but something you're really excited to teach these students.
I'm really excited to teach them about how symbols translate into storytelling. One of the lectures I usually give is about semiotics and how we use semiotics to actually explain stories, which is
semiotics
is like sign language,
okay.
Right? So everybody listening right now, if I told everybody to like draw a house, everybody would draw the same house. It would have a triangle at the top, a square at the bottom. It'd have windows that have T's on them. And nobody draws their own house, right? We draw that symbol of a house. And that symbol is what I think Picasso said was when I was a kid. I could draw like an old master when I was 12. And by the time it took me 25 years to learn to draw like a kid again, right? Because that symbol language is what really connects us.
So one of the producers had pointed out that in your book, Fights, when you refer to somebody referring to you with a racial epithet, rather than using that word, you would often use kind of a minstrel character image.
Right.
Is that a semiotic?
Exactly. That's symbols, right? It's like a sign language. Because when you see that, anybody who sees that knows what that word means.
Knows what that is.
Right? You
yeah.
automatically knows. And what's interesting is that it's separate from the humans. It's separate from the black people in the book, right? And I also wanted to make sure that when black people said the N-word, it was just a word. But when white people were using it in a racist context, they were actually using that imagery, which is like 100 years of history
yeah.
behind that.
Packed. So yeah. much more packed than just the word. Well, this is just the beginning. Joel Christian Gill is author of the graphic novel Fights, One Boy's Triumph Over Violence, and the chair of Boston University's new MFA program in visual narrative. Thanks for day one. I look forward to having you back again.
It's going to be dope.
It will be. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beland, and Sydney Bowles, with Bart Tachi and Andrea Perdomo Hernandez. We had help today also from Rob Lane. Marquise Neal is our senior technical director. Titus Faladun is our executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for joining us. Hope you'll do it again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.